Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Oh my God, we get paid for this. Well, mostly.
So far.
Hey everybody, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I am Molly Wood, and welcome back to Make Me Smart, the podcast where we are joined, as always and at long last, by you. Because none of us is as smart as all of us, and we missed you.
We did. We did. It's been a long-ish couple of months that we have been gone. We are back in the studio again. Although, full disclosure, I'm not actually in L.A., if that matters. I'm in New Haven, but that's a whole different thing. We'll talk about that later.
Kai's at Yale.
I'm at Yale, the Yale Broadcast Center. I will tell you, it's very nice. Lots to talk about this week. Guests as well. Ai-Jen Poo is on the pod this week. She is somebody who is bridging the concerns of domestic workers and Hollywood, the Me Too movement, Time's Up, all of that stuff, around issues of sexual harassment and assault and really equal treatment in the workplace. And it's a good interview.
Yeah, it's like we're looking at whether Me Too is working for everyone, not just capitalism.
Not just capitalism. Right.
In a little bit, we are going to hop back in audio time. It's amazing. What do we want? A time machine. When do we want it? It's irrelevant.
No.
10
oh, that's
years
good.
Ago.
I've never heard that. That's so funny. Is that like a tech
okay.
joke?
Okay. I just
like
heard it on joke. Terminator Genesis, which is like the crappy movie that's my favorite show on FX right now. And that makes me laugh.
Oh my
every
God.
Time.
That's awesome. I love that.
See how much we missed you guys? See how excited we are to be back? Nowhere near focusing. However, we are going to hop in our audio time machine, go back to 2008, because 10 years ago, which is right about now, yeah, 10 yeah. years ago, is when a very large domino fell in the path on the Great Recession.
And if you think back, it was a scary, scary time. We'll talk about that first, though, because you wanted it, and we know because we asked, you got it. Here comes.
That's right. It's the news fix. Sorta. Okay. So we asked you, you told us, you all wanted the news fix. We want an opportunity to talk about the news. We are going to do our best in the interest of the fact that you hear the show weekly and not daily or hourly, as the news cycle occasionally demands. We are going to do our best to talk about the news in the context of the big themes of this show that we have been pursuing and intend to pursue. When we left on the break, we were sort of mid-conversation on a lot of those themes. Some of them are very easy to pick up right now, but we did some brainstorming on kind of new directions that we'd like to go in the next few months, too.
Yeah, so you go ahead, because frankly, I'm drawing a blank. Well, I was making notes on other
remember?
Stuff, and I lost you. this is radio production in real life, people.
I know. Guys, like, I have no idea what we were talking about back before we went on break, because that was 10,000 news stories ago. One thing that we're going to try to do is sort of go back to, remember in our very earliest episodes, we talked about the idea of business as like the fourth leg mm-hmm. of checks and balances
oh, right. okay.
in the
yes.
United States. So yep. that is a conversation we left sort of midway, and that has taken yep. on some super interesting hues, I would say, yep. As the months have gone on, because on the one hand, you know, I saw a headline that said Apple may have just saved the GOP by announcing that it would repatriate, you know, however much, mm-hmm. $280 billion or something, back yeah. to the United States as a result of the tax cut. But on the other hand, you had Walmart and Dick's Sporting Goods say, you know, if the government's not going to act on gun control, we yep. are, from the retail yep. perspective, and consumers and students now have joined yep. the mix as sort of like a lever forcing businesses to be that checks and balance. So it's gotten very interesting.
Right. No, it totally is. And I'm now back up to speed and remember our prior conversations. Here's the other thing we were talking about.
Good.
Early
Welcome.
In the – well, thank you very much. It's nice to be back. The other thing we were talking about was this whole idea of normal, not normal, and how those paradigms are shifting. And I would argue after 3 months away – was it 3 months, 2 months away-ish –
That is coming back to life again with a lot of the things we're seeing in the economy and how businesses are reacting to what is happening on sort of the national security slash economic side of the house with the tariffs and how they were imposed, and let alone the whole North Korea thing. So there's a whole bunch of stuff going on out there that fits in, not to say we were, seeing the future, but fits into what we were talking about a year ago. And it's kind of interesting now to see it coming sort of full circle-ish, if you will.
Yeah. We were talking then, and we'll continue to talk about whether capitalism is working for everyone, whether movements related to that work for everyone, which gets to our interview today. And this idea that I've been kicking around, which is that, like, discrimination is bad capitalism, that when the economy literally doesn't work for everyone, then the economy doesn't work. And we've seen some data points to that effect. There's a pretty recent study that says that gender equality would add $12 trillion to the global economy. The Economic Policy Institute put out a report just last month, actually, looking at sort of 50 years after this Kerner Commission report, which looked at racial and wealth inequality in America, and said that Marketplace did some reporting on this as well. It is still happening, that the racial inequality and the wealth gap is still extreme in this country.
Yeah. So, you know what's interesting, actually, and now that the tax law, not tax bill, but now that the tax law is in effect, and people are seeing some of the benefits of it in their paychecks, companies are repatriating money, as you mentioned, all of those things. It is interesting to see what the perceived effect is of economic policy at the national level trickling down to people in their pocketbooks as the economy seems to be doing pretty well, right? And now what is happening with those things like economic inequality? And I'm not saying we have the answer now, right? But it's something that's in the news right now, but which is going to play out over the next 18 months to three-ish years, right? What economic policy that's going into place now is going to mean in terms of some of the big issues, whether capitalism works, whether inequality is being – I was about to say whether inequality is being equally distributed. What I meant was whether the income inequality gap is narrowing or widening, right? All of those things are playing out sort of in real time. And the challenge, honestly, for those of us, Molly, and I don't know how you feel about this in tech and sort of the stuff that you really focus in on closely, but I was thinking about this the other day. The challenge is, for those of us who are in the news every single day, is to not get lost in the moment, but to say, listen, in 6 months, we need to revisit this. We need to revisit the tax law. We need to revisit the North Korea negotiations. We need to revisit whatever it is and say, listen, what actually is the long-term effect of what is happening that we just got bogged down in because we were freaking out about, you know, this tweet or that tweet, you know?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. We've been talking about in the tech industry, as there's been this, you know, the zeitgeist around the tech industry has changed even since, you know, the beginning of our first episodes of Make Me Smart. And there's a lot of talk of unintended consequences. And I am of the feeling that unintended consequences are not necessarily unforeseeable. And history can be your guide. There was a great tweet the other day, actually, because, you know, there's been quite a dust up about the New York Times opinion pages. And there was a great tweet the other day that basically said that the Times should just replace all of its opinion writers and have guest columns by economists, historians, and professors, you know. And I was like, wait, no, don't do that, because that could be our show, right? Like, we can do some of that analysis and should, frankly, and say, you know, what do we think are going to be the results of this? How can we predict the unintended consequences and maybe try to mitigate them? And so this is my pitch, too, to get like a super hardcore data scientist on the show. Like, couldn't we just feed a machine a bunch of variables and spit out what's going to happen?
Totally. Totally.
And then the other thing that has been a tentpole of our show is this idea of discourse, right? The idea of reason, of trying to understand issues all the way down to the bottom so that you're not so reactive. And that led us to want to explore really this idea of compromise. And as our producer Jenny has put it, rebooting compromise, which I think is just wonderful. Like, can we just turn it off and turn back on again?
Well, see, that's really interesting, right? Because I worry, honestly, that we're in a place now where compromise is not possible. And you see politicians in Washington saying, oh, yeah, we got agreement on this one tiny little thing, and we're going to call that compromise, when, in fact, on the deep and substantive issues facing this country, both in technology and culture and the economy, there's not a whole lot of common ground. And that, frankly, I think is a little depressing. But maybe that's just me.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, it can be, which is why, and this is where we do our thing. This is where I'll pick you up. I'm going to try to make you feel better. There's a good way to look at this, which is that maybe, because there have been other times in throughout history, you know, when people were so deeply divided. There was the Civil War, right? Like there have, I mean, hopefully totally. We're not going to, hopefully it's not going to get that much worse before it gets better. But one of the things that could stop it from getting that much worse is trying to look back at times when common ground has been found. And this is really a zeitgeist. There was like a wonderful piece in the New York Times, actually, about New York City History Day competition, which was all these students got together and the theme of it was conflict and compromise in history. So there's this zeitgeist about people trying to say, what's it going to take other than aliens landing to help us find common ground?
Yeah.
And that's something that we want to explore on our show. I mean, aliens could land. We would unify. I'm just saying. We'd be like,
Let's remember the title of that cookbook that they eventually figured out. Let's remember. It was To Serve Man, and it was a cookbook. I'm just saying. Do you remember that?
No.
Do you not remember that?
No idea what you're talking about.
All right.
Help me out. Make me smart,
Kai. It was like the day the Earth stood still or one of those science fiction movies, and aliens came and they were welcomed, and people, after a little bit of terror, they were welcomed and everything was great and they got along and this and that. And then the closing scene is the aliens taking humans back onto the spaceship. I think I'm remembering this. And as the humans are going onto this spaceship, some scientist comes running up and says, this book that they had called To Serve Man, it's not actually serving man for good. It's serving man. It's a cookbook. I'm just saying. Was it the Twilight Zone? Producer Jenny just whispered in my ear. Was it Twilight Zone? No way. Might have been.
Hilarious.
Anyway.
Okay, well, that's not what I meant.
I know it's not what you meant.
And then also, and before we get to our audio time machine, I do want to point out one bit of good news, particularly on the compromise front, which is that apparently millennials and even Generation Z are quitting social media.
Really?
Which, frankly, can only help our discourse. So that's good news. Yeah. Like more than a third of young users have said goodbye to social media. That includes all social apps. Snap, Twitter.
Like Snap, too. Wow.
Especially Facebook and even Tinder. They're not even Tindering.
Well, that's a whole different kind of
so
thing.
So both saying. Love and discourse could be saved. I believe the children are our future.
And with that,
let's do some history. All right, next up, we are going to do, as I mentioned, a little history of media exercise with sound. That music you heard behind me is the theme for this project, and we're calling it The Divided Decade. It is so marketplace-y. It is a look back at the financial crisis of 2008 across all the shows. We're going to be covering it on Tech. It's on Weekend. It's on Morning. It's on Kai Show, and it's here at Make Me Smart. And so we're sort of wondering, we're looking back right now at what we were talking about on the air this week-ish. 10 years ago, right? Kai, do you know what you're saying on Marketplace? Oh, no, wait. I know, because there's an archive.
I don't actually know. I haven't heard the tape.
Oh, well, here you go.
For $2 a share today, you could have bought into Sirius, the satellite radio company, or Level 3 Communications. They do networking stuff. Or you could have picked up a piece of a bank you might have heard of. Bear Stearns was going cheap today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, California, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, the 17th of March. Glad to have you with us. To be clear, that $2 a share for Bear Stearns wasn't available to the general public. It's what J.P. Morgan said last night it's going to pay to take over its smaller and far more troubled competitor, with a little help from the Federal Reserve. But I'm getting ahead of myself. The news from Friday might be a good place to begin this afternoon. That's when we learned J.P. Morgan and the New York Fed were going to be propping up.
Seriously,
can we turn it off? Can we turn it off? Can we turn it off?
Let it run.
God.
Wow,
oh
you sound really
God.
Different.
God. Oh,
you're
my
just
God.
A baby.
Why are you guys doing this to me? I thought you were like my colleagues and supporters and friends. Oh, man. That is excruciating.
I will say, even though I introduced it, I didn't know. I didn't know that was going to happen.
That is excruciating. So let's review and remind people who that moron was on the radio that you just heard there. So that was the show from 10 years ago this week. Bear Stearns week, bought out by J.P. Morgan for $2, eventually $10 a share with $29 billion worth of help from the Federal Reserve. It was the point at which I think the financial crisis and the Great Recession that was to come was starting really to take hold, and people started getting really, really scared because the idea of a major investment bank on Wall Street just going and evaporating like Bear Stearns did was kind of, oh my God, amazing. Wow.
It's funny because you don't sound that stressed. You know, you're like, it's going cheap.
Well, so you know, it's interesting. So in reality, the financial crisis had been going for a year by that point, maybe a little bit more, right? Mm-hmm. And credit was getting really tight and people were getting really concerned. And you had economists saying, oh, yeah, this could be bad. And we in the business press had been covering it for a while. And if you go back now, when I went back and started listening to some of our coverage from 2008 just to get ready for this for our Divided Decade project, I instantaneously got that queasy feeling in my stomach. I truly, truly did. But by March of 2008 – we've been dealing with it for a while, right? Economists and analysts and the people that I was talking to on Marketplace had been dealing with it for a year. And so we kind of knew. But I think to the general public, they were like, oh, my God, Wall Street is falling apart. And this is where it started this weekend with Bear Stearns mm-hmm. getting bailed out by the – and by the – not bailed out, getting rescued by the Fed and by J.P. Morgan. That, I think, is where it really started. But, yeah. Oh, my God, I sound terrible on the radio. I don't know why anybody listens.
Jeez. Oh, you do not. Although apparently, were you not different. Even in the country? I heard.
Well,
like
so that's the other part. So yeah, so we were in Dubai that week for a long planned series of overseas broadcasts.
Dang.
The morning show had gone to Egypt. the morning show had gone to Egypt. I was in Dubai for a week. Yeah, so it was like 2 o'clock in the morning Dubai time when we were doing that. But yeah, man. That holy cow! That was kind of amazing.
Bear Stearns stock, I see in our notes, yeah, fell from almost $100 to $2 in 5 days.
Oh yeah, yeah, it went for nothing, and that was the thing that really got you about the financial crisis was the speed with which this all unwound. But turnabout being fair play, there is, I believe, back at Marketplace World headquarters in Los Angeles, tape queued up of you from 10 years ago, which na-na-na-na boo boo, we're gonna play.
It's Wednesday, March 12th, 2008.
I'm Molly Wood.
I'm Tom Merritt.
I'm Jason Howell.
Welcome to Buzz Out Loud, CNET's podcast of indeterminate length. That's episode 679. I totally missed the opportunity yesterday to say 678.
678, yeah.
So say 679.
Didn't even catch it.
Not the same.
Not
six,
the
seven,
same.
Skip 8.
Kind of a letdown, frankly.
Oh, well.
Okay, 678, number one, you're a dork. Number two, you sound exactly the same.
Well, as you may have heard, I had already done 679 episodes of a daily podcast by that time.
Yeah.
So I had like a lot of practice just talking to my homies. But I love how we have a clip where you sound really smart and you're talking about Bear Stearns and junk. And I'm like, I wish I had gotten to say 6, 7, and 8. Really? We couldn't have found a clip where I sound at least smarter than a fourth grader.
Well, hang on. There's more sound coming here. What was the big story that day? Do we know?
Time Warner CEO says he would like to party with Yahoo.
Yeah.
Yahoo AOL deal should not be ruled out. According to a report in MarketWatch, chief executive Jeff Books told investors at the Bear Stearns media conference that he would consider an acquisition that would make AOL stronger. Did the whole, like, whatever is good for the shareholders, right. We'll consider it sort of dance.
But kind of interesting that he didn't rule it out. Although he also noted that a Microsoft Yahoo deal could benefit AOL by validating the benefits of an advertising network.
Sure.
So I don't know. It was interesting.
All right. You know what's amazing about that piece of tape?
Little did we know that both of those things would happen.
Well, right. But what's amazing about that piece of tape is that you mentioned four companies, three of which are no longer in existence.
I know.
Right? I mean, AOL, I suppose, still exists, but not really. Yahoo, as we know, is kind of gone. And Bear Stearns is kind of gone.
And Bear Stearns is gone. That's crazy.
Time, man.
And all of the things that we predicted there did happen. Yahoo and AOL. Well, except for Microsoft. Okay. We should back up here. Yeah. that show that you're listening to was a daily podcast. That was my first baby. A podcast at CNET called Buzz Out Loud. You heard my co-host, Tom Merritt.
Does your actual baby know that? I'm just saying.
I try not to tell him. But yeah. There were almost 2,000 episodes of that show.
Wow.
We did it every single day. We talked about technology and business for a really long time. And I think it is kind of ironic that we were talking about events at the Bear Stearns conference.
Yeah, no kidding.
As Bear Stearns was falling apart. Anyway, fascinating. That's what we were talking. But what's so interesting, and maybe we should go back to this story, which, because I think you were talking about it on Marketplace at the same time, which is that in 2008, the big, you know, business story was that Microsoft had made this unsolicited bid to take over Yahoo for $44.6 billion. Reportedly, Microsoft was ready to pay $50 billion. I did a little video. There was a companion video show to Buzz Out Loud, the podcast called The Buzz Report, where I took Yahoo into the bathroom and told her that she should totally take the ring, girl.
Wow.
But the struggle went on for months. Yahoo did not want to take the ring, tried to find other buyers. And then, of course, Yahoo eventually was acquired by Verizon and merged with AOL in 2017 for 10 times less money.
Yeah.
But meanwhile, in the interim, the economy fell apart.
Well, right. And the point of us going down memory lane here and listening to old tape is that it's really important and yet incredibly difficult to think about what is happening while it's happening. And I'm reminded of a podcast I just discovered the other day called Slow Burn. It's about Watergate and how all these things were happening in the middle of Watergate that 25 years later, you'll come back and go, oh, yeah, of course that was an issue. And of course that was a problem. And it's interesting now to be 10 years out from the financial crisis, looking back at that and going, huh, so that was happening then. And this was happening over here. And oh, my God, of course this all fell apart. It's remarkable. And anyway, so to get to the point of why I'm in New Haven and at Yale, I'm sitting down this week with Tim Geithner, Ben Bernanke, and Henry Paulson, two Treasury secretaries and a former chairman of the Fed. Tim Geithner, I would say, was president of the New York Fed back then. But anyway, those three guys were, in essence, the committee to save the world when the financial crisis was falling apart. And we're going to get to sort of their perspective 10 years on of what, who knew, and when, and why they did certain things, which is sort of an interesting opportunity to get, I think.
Yeah, you may know them as the stars of Too Big to Fail.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Which I actually just watched, sort of, with all of this in mind. I finally watched Too Big to Fail for the first time, I don't know, 2 weeks ago or something. So then, of course, I was like, those guys are so famous. Because apparently I'm still doing what I was doing 10 years ago.
I'm going to be sure to lead with that tomorrow. Oh, my God, you guys are so famous. Actually, that's a question, right?
Well, I think the question to them is, because certainly the movie makes it seem like they all were fully aware of the magnitude of what was coming. And so how important is it to be in the room where it happens? And how important is it for the public not to be in that room, right? Because there would have been total panic.
Right. Yeah, sorry, I'm actually just jotting down a note because that's a good question.
Well, you're welcome.
No, that's a good question. I will do without the Hamilton reference, of course, the whole room where it happens. But yeah. What?
We got to find a new show. We got to find a new musical or something for our. Maybe it's all maybe it's Hamill Drops. Like we start looking at all the spin-off songs.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which aren't they're not doing it for me. But anyway.
I know. Except for the Ben Franklin one, but has too many swears.
Yes.
Coming up in a moment, we're going to sit down with a labor organizer who has also been working the red carpet. It's Ai-Jen Poo of the National Domestic Workers Alliance. She has a lot to say about how workers are protected, how they aren't, and how they're being represented as this kind of Me Too movement and this earthquake in business and Hollywood sort of shakes the country.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.
So a little more on our first guest on our return to Make Me Smart. Ai-Jen Poo has thought a lot about work and wages and equity. She was a MacArthur Genius Fellow in 2014, all because of her longtime efforts leading the National Domestic Workers Alliance.
She has been seen, though, of late in a whole different light, a spotlight, actually, walking the red carpet at the Golden Globes in front of cameras from around the world as the guest of Meryl Streep, no less, which is kind of awesome. We're going to talk to her about that. It was all about the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund. That's how she got the invitation. And it's an interesting piece of tape to listen to. Ryan Seacrest, which is an interesting choice if you know anything about his recent issues with the press, I suppose, was asking the questions. Here's the red carpet tape. Go ahead.
Well, I think that people are aware now of a power imbalance. And it's something that leads to abuse. It's everywhere. And we want to fix that. And we feel sort of emboldened in this particular moment to stand together in a thick black line, dividing then from now.
Both men and women, too, yes. As well.
Yes.
And Ai-Jen, what do you hope people take away from this evening?
I hope people see the momentum and the energy and the fact that we're uniting across all industries and all communities, standing together saying we all deserve workplaces where we're safe and where our work is valued and we can live and work with dignity. That's the future. And we have momentum. This is a movement where there's space for everyone and there's a role for everyone.
Hmm. So we talked to her about how you sort of thread the needle on those two worlds, organizing tens of thousands of honestly some of the most forgotten workers in this economy, but also dealing with and trying to in some ways capitalize on a relationship you're developing with the rich and the powerful and the celebrity. And Molly, as is our custom, started the questions.
You, like so many Hollywood stories, are an overnight success that's been working for 20 years.
Right.
You've been working, you know, with the National Domestic Workers Alliance for decades, and then you became this plus one at the Golden Globes. Can we just start there and tell us about the moment, the voicemail?
Yes. Well, I had known that the women in Hollywood were organizing. And then I heard a rumor that Meryl Streep might be contacting me, which, of course, you never quite believe until it actually happens. And you check your voicemail and there's a message from Meryl Streep asking you to call her back, which I did.
Did she actually say, Ai-Jen, this is Meryl Streep?
Yes, she did.
Wow.
Oh, my gosh.
Needless to say, I will save that.
Did you feel a little bit like a stranger in a strange land?
I definitely did. Yeah. I've never been on a red carpet before, and so all of the cameras and the flashing lights and energy was definitely jarring and also incredibly exciting. It really felt historic.
Do me a favor and tell us who it is that you represent and then some of the challenges those people face that mostly white and wealthy women now are coming forward saying we've had some of those analogous experiences.
Well, so I represent this workforce that goes to work in our homes every day, caring for our children as nannies, caring for our aging parents and grandparents as home care workers, home health aides, and cleaning our homes as house cleaners. And it's we call it the work that makes all other work possible because it makes it possible for us to go and do what we do every day, knowing that some of the most important aspects of our lives are in good hands. And yet it's some of the most undervalued and invisible work in our economy. And if you think about it, it's like you could go into any neighborhood and not know which homes are also workplaces, right? They're not registered anywhere. It's not like there's a list where you could, you know, identify. And then it's also this situation where, you know, there's no water cooler, there's no lunch room, there are no coworkers, there's no HR department, certainly. And it's incredibly isolating too. So, you know, we've been talking about the power imbalance between men and women in our economy. And if you think about the power imbalance in that environment, it is really, really quite stark. And so domestic workers, you know, it's a little bit unpredictable because you might have a wonderful family who you stay with for years and sometimes generations. And then there's also human trafficking, modern-day slavery-type cases, rape and sexual assault, and everything in between.
Mm-hmm. And then what about working on, you know, we talk a lot on this show about how the economy doesn't always work for everyone, and the power imbalance fundamentally is what allows this behavior to go on. You know, interestingly, I was just having makeup done for a video shoot at Marketplace and was talking to a makeup artist who said that throughout Hollywood, there are all of these independent women who do makeup and who have no protection and who get sexually harassed on the job all the time. And even if they're in unions, they're showing up at hotel rooms at 5 a.m. to do makeup. And so what, I guess, as you look down the road, you know, what can be done to kind of address these structural power imbalances and to even maybe look, get Hollywood actresses to say, hey, talk to the person who's doing your makeup in a trailer.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things about our protections for workers, for working people, is that they emerged in the context of a fundamentally different economy. When we put our labor laws in place, it was a manufacturing-based economy, massive shop floors, and a nationally based economy. We now have a globalized world, and we're in the middle of the fourth industrial revolution where technology is changing everything. And we have not updated our policy frameworks for how we protect workers for several generations. And so there are major gaps in terms of who is protected and how they're protected. And I represent a workforce that was actually left out of the original protections. So we've been operating in this context of lawlessness for generations. And that's why I think it's women like the makeup artists who are independent contractors who have also been left out, and workers like domestic workers who need to be shaping the protections for the future. Right now, under the Title VII anti-discrimination laws that are the main way that working women find protections from harassment and discrimination, you have to work in a workplace with at least 15 employees. I mean, think about how many workplaces that excludes, right?
Mm-hmm.
How do you keep your eye on the long view ball when the needs are so instant right now? I mean, as you just said, the people you represent are not currently legally protectable, right?
That's right. There are major loopholes that millions of women are falling through the cracks of our protections at this moment. I would say, though, that every single employer has a responsibility and an opportunity to look at their own internal policies. There's nothing stopping individual organizations and companies from strengthening their sexual harassment policies today, right? And so that has to be a part of the culture and norm change in our economy.
Let me ask a related question then, based on something we talked about last year on this podcast, which is the idea of making capitalism work for more people. Right now, you know, as you said, JPMorgan Chase can change its HR policies to make sure that the people cleaning the offices at night in some subcontractor are protected. But I guess the question is, how do we make capitalism work better for more people? Because that is that's the nut.
Yes, that's a really big question. I will say that is the defining challenge of our generation, I think. We live in a current economy where 70% of the American workforce earns less than $50,000 per year. And when you start to think about what it costs to pay for rent, what it costs for food, childcare, it is unimaginable, right? The numbers just don't actually work. They don't work for most working people. And so we do have to figure out how to make work pay fundamentally in this economy. There are too many people who are working incredibly hard and still unable to make ends meet. My workforce, home care workers, the annual median income for a home care worker is $13,000 per year. So the people that we're counting on to take care of us and the people we love can't take care of themselves and their own kids on the incomes they earn, which is just, there's something fundamentally, there's a fundamental design flaw there.
Hi, Jim Poo. We want to ask you, before we let you go, our Make Me Smart question, which goes like this, and I feel like you're going to have a great answer. What is something that you once thought you knew and you later found out you were wrong about?
I thought I understood how change happens. You need champions who you elect to office to essentially create solutions and solve problems for us. Like, we basically relegate or delegate to our so-called leaders to solve our problems for us. And the longer I do this work, the more I realize that that's actually not how it works. That it's everyday acts of courage and connection and civic participation that actually enable and propel change forward. It's people. And I think people in all corners of society are starting to realize this Alice Walker famous quote of, we are the ones we've been waiting for. We are the leaders we've been waiting for. Every single day that that becomes more and more true to me.
I love that so much.
Ai-Jen Poo. Kind of amazing.
Ai-Jen Poo.
Yeah, the answer is amazing. The thing about that interview that really struck me now listening back is how to match that sentiment, which is amazing, up with the celebrity culture that is now paying attention to that as a result of Time's Up and Me Too, and whether that is sustainable, right? Because Ai-Jen Poo has been doing this for, like, I don't know, what, like 10, 15 years? And it will be interesting to see if the attention from the celebrity culture, the, it has to be said, white upper class celebrity culture, endures.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we should say that one of the things that Ai-Jen Poo has been so particularly brilliant at is getting this attention to turn into money. Like, I think she, in partnership with Hollywood, has, you know, and that's kind of, at the end of the day, what it comes down to. I think she, let's see, Shonda Rhimes, Reese Witherspoon, and 300 other actors raised more than $19 million to help low-wage women workers. I think that she, if anything else, like, Hollywood's attention may fade, hers will not. And that is pretty profound,
totally,
especially given her answer to that question.
Absolutely. Speaking of the answer to that question, we're doing that. We're still doing it. The Make Me Smart question. What is something you thought you knew, but it turns out you were wrong about?
Yeah. And we want to hear the answers from you as well. That's like one of our favorite parts of the question. So please record your answer on your phone and send it to us. All the iPhones have a built-in voice memo, and Android has many third-party apps available. Just do a little quick recording. We had to do a video about this because it's so...
We did. Whatever happened to that video? Did it never see the light of day? We should get it out
there. I don't know, but now that we're back, we should start re-promoting it for sure.
There were like shots of your hands on the buttons and everything.
So much B-roll, you guys. So much B-roll. Email it to us, makemesmart@marketplace.org. You will be incentivized to keep these to 30 or 45 seconds because otherwise your file won't send. It'll be too big. More from all of you next. Welcome back, everyone. While we have been on break, welcome back. In every possible way. While we've been on our little hiatus, the Make Me Smart inbox has been filling up. I have to say, I mean, I'm not awesome at managing email, but I still notice that a lot of the email that I get every day is from the Make Me Smart inbox. I mean,
totally true.
I feel so gratified at how into our show you are.
Yeah, and we are going to run through some of those comments right about now. Here we go.
Where do we mail a letter?
In the mailbox.
In the mailbox. Lots of you took up there's been a lot of follow-up on conscious capitalism, moral capitalism. We still haven't, you know, we're just going to call it all those things, including this next guy who sent us a recording.
Hi, Molly and Kai. My name is Philip, and I'm a structural engineering consultant. I heard you say a few times during the year that a company's board of directors and CEO have a fiduciary duty to maximize shareholder value. My question is this. When did maximizing shareholder value become the dominant goal of company leadership? And had the goal ever simply been protecting shareholder value?
Well, so I'm like 99.874326% positive that I never said that they have a fiduciary responsibility to maximize shareholder value, right? Because in point of fact, we did a whole series on Marketplace on that very idea and how it's in essence been cooked up by companies and CEOs and boards of directors. Not cooked up. That's pejorative. It has been, it has become the norm on Wall Street for decades now that they have to maximize shareholder value. And that's not actually the case. Boards and CEOs have to run the company responsibly, and they have a fiduciary duty to shareholders to run the company responsibly. But there's nothing about maximizing everybody's profit. That's the thing. I have two thoughts, actually, on how it happened. Number one is the increased attention that we pay now, thanks in part to, I have to say, business journalism, to the idea of quarterly profits. And to the idea of companies making those numbers and to the idea that earnings and revenue per share and all that stuff have become paramount. And then the second aspect of it really is a transition, I think, in this economy from companies as corporate citizens to companies as vessels and vehicles for sheer profit. And I think that has been a change that's been a long time in coming. But yeah, it's something that's real, but it's not something that's mandated, I guess, is the idea there.
All right. Nick Turner had some thoughts about Twitter and companies taking a recent moral stand, which obviously we will be covering more in our new episodes. He said to us in a tweet, "Interesting how Walmart and Dick's recent actions play into your Make Me Smart discussions on businesses taking action and being a check on government." We got a lot of tweets to that effect. Mm-hmm. Which is awesome because we're resonating. But worth noting, and in to Kai's point about keeping an eye on things, that Dick's Sporting Goods also did this after the Newtown shootings for a while, temporarily suspended gun sales, and then went back to selling them. So I think it's, you know, just keep eye on the ball, everybody. What do you think? Do we have time to play one more?
Okay, one more. Which one do you like?
Let's do
five.
No, one more. I want to do Allison. She sent us.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No. You go.
I want to make sure it was a she, not a he. That was it.
Oh well, there you go.
That was it.
All right. Let's do Allison because she sent this after hearing our interview with the Gates Foundation CEO Sue Desmond-Hellman. One of the things she talked about was Common Core state standards and education, obviously in the news after a somewhat disastrous outing by Betsy DeVos on 60 Minutes. So let's talk about schools. This listener deals with Common Core every day in her job.
Hi, Kai and Molly. I am one of those public school teachers that was referenced as being affected by Common Core state standards. While I don't expect for the Gates Foundation to take this as their problem, because they were so instrumental in creating the standards and pushing them through, that makes me feel like they do have some responsibility in helping teachers and administrators navigate the standards.
Also, apparently, that is the wife of our engineer, Dan Ramirez. Just want to throw that out there.
And engineer and composer.
And composer, exactly. Music composer.
Yeah. But, you know, so that's an interesting thought, right? Where does the responsibility lie? Because you sit up there in the ivory tower, as it were, of the Gates Foundation or whatever. Or another one is Eli Broad here in Los Angeles, right? And he's been really active in charter schools. And so you have this idea. You put your oomph and your money and your reputation and your bazillions of dollars behind it. And then it's the worker bees like teachers and folks in public policy who have to carry it out. And where does the responsibility lie for helping them do that? I don't know.
Yeah, you break it, you buy it.
That's right. You break it, you buy it.
Right. Well, isn't that does seem to be sort of that's the next question, where foundations and private companies have stepped in and tech companies love to try to fix everybody's problems. What is their plan for dealing with any messes?
Yes.
That they create.
My God. So here you go. And this is where we bring the episode full circle, because we started with, and Molly pointed out after I had my little brain fart, Molly pointed out that one of the things we talked about in the first season that we want to pick up again on and that is happening now in this economy is businesses acting as a check on government, right? And that is something that is happening. But here's sort of the flip side of that coin, which is private entities, whether it's the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation or Warren Buffett or Eli Broad or who have you,
saying to themselves, we want to get active in policy. And Betsy DeVos, the Secretary of Education, is another one who was actually really active in education policy and now is in a position to do something about it, right? If you're going to be active in policy, do you have responsibility then, once you have promulgated your great idea, to support those who are charged with carrying it out if you win the day in the public policy debate?
Yep.
And with that, I drop my pen. Not my microphone, my pen.
I honestly think it should be part of our job to get those people on the line and say, okay, what are you doing?
Totally.
Right?
It's right. The idea of follow-up. Oh, my God. Oh, wait. Oh, my God. It's the idea of follow-up, which gets back to the divided decade thing. Oh, my God. This episode is coming together like in the waning moments.
We're so good at stuff,
in the waning moments.
Oh, come on. It's been together the whole time.
It was all planned.
Been together by a wing and on a wing and a prayer. We hope that you have enjoyed this welcome back episode, this jumbo-sized episode of Make Me Smart, because we sure have. We are delighted to be back. If you have thoughts on our catalog, I know a lot of you were catching up over the break. Thank you for doing that. It's been great to hear you guys, like, you know, as you get to certain episodes, send us comments and send us emails. It's wonderful. So keep it coming. Review us on Apple Podcasts. Tell your friends. Tell them that we're back with new episodes every week.
Please.
Tell your friends. Tell your mom.
I'm just waiting. Here we go. Make Me Smart is produced this week by Jenny Josephson, Shara Morris, and Christopher Olin as well. Our new senior producer is Eve Troh. This week's program was engineered by Jake Gorski. Our theme music is composed by Ben Talladay and Allison Ramirez's husband.
That's right. The executive director of On Demand is Satara Nieves, and the senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. And we are us, and now we get to dance. Yes!
I'm not. No, God, no. I'm going to go out into the streets of New Haven and see if it's snowing yet. There's a nor'easter coming, you know.
I do. Be safe out there. Yeah. It's 60 degrees and sunny here. I know. Sorry.
That sounded. That's kind of good.
Just like you think it sounded.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Jerez, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.